morning, Your Honors. Michael Murphy on behalf of Northwest Cascade. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I want to start out this argument by calling attention to the Curtis case that we cited in a statement of additional authority last week. That's a Western District of Washington decision handed down about 6 weeks ago. And I think it really crystallizes the common sense notion here that when a shareholder dissipates corporate cash by paying personal expenses, that is an intentional abuse of the corporate form that harms creditors because those funds are no longer available to pay the creditors. It's a very simple concept. The facts here are virtually identical to the facts in the Curtis case that warranted summary judgment. Now, the diversion and the trial court gave Mr. Ray a pass on veil piercing based on two notions. One, that the diversion and dissipation was de minimis and didn't harm Cascade, and it was not done fraudulently or with the intent to defraud. Now, on the first issue, there's no substantial evidence to support the notion that these were de minimis transfers. The record is very clear. Plaintiff's expert testified based on bank, credit card, and other records that the Rays diverted a minimum of $177,000 in cash or cash equivalents during the very period that the lawsuit or that the contract is being performed and wasn't paid. Other than quibbling over the imputed rental rate for the house, the corporate house that they were living in, the Rays offered no evidence to the contrary on this issue. It is undisputed that after these diversions, Unique was left with $5,600 in its bank account. The amount unpaid at that point to Cascade was over $150,000, including interest. Now, this large cash diversion was in addition to the post-lawsuit transfer of corporate real property.
When is it a diversion and when is it a draw?
When is it a diversion and when is it a draw?
The treatment of this.
Well, now that you get into the issue.
Practically, as apart from maybe a CPA's view, depending on whose CPA it is, when it is a diversion and when it is a draw, because many people with LLCs, if not most, because they are small entities generally, tend to take draws because they're going to have to declare it all as income anyway.
Yes, in fact, here, Your Honor, there was no reflection of these diversions as draws on the corporate tax returns as testified to by our expert and not refuted at the trial. So these were not draws, and there's no evidence to that effect in the record. So the question you ask is, well, interesting, if there were a record of that, is not pertinent in this case.
That may be a good answer. Thank you.
Yeah. Now, the trial court, to jump to the next issue here, the trial court expressly refused to consider the transfer of corporate real property, the 38th Avenue property, in determining whether veil piercing was appropriate. Now, the record shows that the court was simply wrong in saying it wasn't asked to do this. We asked the court in our complaint, in our trial brief, and in oral argument to do that. Now, the trial court appeared to be confused about the issue of whether it could consider that, and it just didn't. But if you look at the Morgan case, which is discussed extensively by both parties, corporate gutting is compelling evidence supporting veil piercing, and in fact, under Morgan, can be reason enough to pierce the corporate veil.
What concerned me in the findings of fact is I think we're clear the court knows both properties were transferred, knows the timing of the transfers, doesn't make findings that one way or the other. It's the absence of findings, not erroneous findings. What do we do with this record and your claim?
Well,
I know she considered it. I guess that's the point.
Well, no, she didn't consider it. The evidence was introduced. We know that from the record, but we also have her on the record simply stating she is not going to consider it. That is in the verbatim report of proceedings. And she specifically said that, and it came up at least two or three times at different hearings where we said, no, you have to consider this under the Morgan case. And the court said, no, I'm not going to consider that. I haven't been asked to assess this issue as a fraudulent transfer. The court, I believe, was confused about that.
But that's a distinction from piercing the veil. I mean, the argument's clear that she's saying, I'm not going to look at the fraudulent aspect, and very focused on trying to bring her back. The question is, did she look at that evidence and simply conclude there's an innocent explanation?
No, there's no record to support that. There was no innocent explanation either in the record or in her findings that she said that. And in fact, the countervailing point would be the jury verdict on the 89th Street property. And in fact, she did agree that there was intent to defraud in connection with that transfer, and the transfers were all part and parcel of a common scheme.
Okay, but she may have viewed that as having been remedied. So look at the other property.
Right.
Wasn't there evidence that this was done as an estate planning transfer? Could she have bought into that and, within her discretion, concluded there is no misconduct?
Well, there's no estate planning when you're transferring corporate assets for no consideration to yourself personally. And if that was her finding, which there isn't a finding to that effect, that would not be supported by substantial evidence and I think would be a clear error of law. That's not estate planning. Estate planning is minimizing taxes, things of that nature, controlling where your assets go, not stripping a company of assets and giving them to entities that you control personally.
Apparently crossed out the proposed finding that it was transferred, the 89th Street property was transferred for no consideration. What do we do with that? Isn't that evidence that she's concluding at least there's no evidence it was a gratuitous transfer?
I don't specifically recall that strikeout, but that was a jury verdict question, the 89th Street property.
Well, then I think it's the 38th. I just recall that the findings 39th. Of fact were edited.
Who made the determination of what went to the jury and what didn't?
That was largely agreed upon by the parties that the veil piercing issues went to the court and that the issues, all the other issues, the fraudulent transfer issues, went to the jury along with the contract
if
dispute.
If what you're arguing with regard to the 38th Street property is that it was a fraudulent transfer, then isn't the trial court perhaps entitled to be somewhat confused in terms of what you elected to give to the jury or what issues you elected to reserve to her?
Well,
sense some of that from what I see as some confusion.
I don't disagree that the court was somewhat confused, but I think that the record is very clear that we tried to clarify any confusion. I think you have to back up the train just a little bit because the reason why the 38th Avenue property was introduced later into the case was because the facts related to that were concealed by the defendants in this case. And by the time we were on the eve of trial, at least the originally scheduled trial, in 2011, we did not believe that there would be such an adverse impact of this case continuing yet another couple of years that we elected to use that as evidence supporting the veil piercing claim. The other point on the veil piercing is that you have the asset stripping of that asset, but you also have the substantial diversion of cash, which I think is equally critical, and those things go hand in hand.
It was finding 22 with respect to 38th Street that I was referring to. So you can.
May it please the court, Martin Burns here on behalf of the respondents and cross appellants. We really have three issues before the court. One is the piercing, two is the fees to the raise, and the third is the fees to Northwest Cascade. With regards to the piercing claim, I think it comes down to a misconception by Northwest Cascade that somehow by the court not making a finding, it did not consider evidence. Evidence that it admitted, evidence that came into trial in the way of a quitclaim deed, a real estate excise tax affidavit, evidence that was testified to by witnesses, and I put a list of where all it was testified in my brief.
Well, quit
on page 11.
Claiming it for no consideration as a non-tax transfer doesn't establish much other than you're not going to keep the property.
It's putting it into they were putting it into Black Point Management.
Putting
part
it out of reach of creditors that already had known claims against them.
Well,
I'm shocked the trial court looked at those two transfers and the way they ran the business and didn't conclude there should have been piercing.
Well, there's many reasons that the court put in findings as to why it didn't. That they really, while they gave lip service to in the assignment of errors, did not really argue in their brief, were wrong. For instance, the trial court said Northwest Cascade did not try to protect itself, much like the Truckwell case. They didn't ask for security. They didn't ask for personal guarantees. They never looked at the financials.
But the notion of piercing is the conduct of the person who's acted badly, not the person who was doing business with them.
Okay. But the conduct that they are talking about, much of the case, occurred years, decades before.
But it's not a caveat emptor kind of theory. It's just the opposite. The actor is acting so badly, okay. We're not putting
fire
on notice.
I think you touched on it earlier as to what the appropriate remedy is. And in the Meisel case says, look, if you're going to do a fraudulent transfer and you avoid the transfer, that's the appropriate remedy here, and we don't have to pierce the corporate veil. Now, this is a matter, piercing the corporate veil, by the way, is an extraordinary remedy that is to be used sparingly, and it is to, within the sound discretion of the trial court to sit there and weigh the evidence. And the court sat there and weighed the evidence. There was 153 exhibits in this case. There were six witnesses, and the court did not put a finding in for each and every little exhibit that went in. Now, the court did consider...
But the court has almost 20 findings with respect to the dissipation of a few dollars here and a few dollars there and how this was sloppy bookkeeping. But the only two major assets that could have paid any of the major bills get transferred out, and the court ignores that?
The court did not ignore that. And, in fact, when we first went into the court on the findings of facts and conclusion of law, not on the part that they put in their brief, but on the first hearing on April 27, 2012, when I originally brought this up, they had put in another line that said the 38th Street property is a fraudulent transfer. I said, that wasn't tried to the jury. That wasn't asked for you to be decided. And the judge said, that's right, take that out. I said, and you need to take out the next line as well, the one about the consideration. That was not before the court as well.
What I'm asking you, I guess, is where are the findings by the trial court that explain why those two transfers of the only meaningful assets of the company don't merit piercing the veil?
She found the reasons why she wasn't going to pierce the corporate veil. I think you're asking for negative findings, the reasons the court didn't do something. The court made
the
very
question,
detailed.
But that's the question. Did she properly consider the evidence? She's focused a great deal on the alternative, the third theory, that is that they didn't keep good books and they just kept siphoning a few bucks here and there.
But she also noted that they had the remedy with the Fraudulent Conveyance Act. But the court did consider this. When
is a piece of that, the trial court's thinking that they should have tried the 38th Street property as a fraudulent conveyance? I mean,
which, by the way, they have done. And we now have an oral ruling from Judge Hogan, and I'd like to be able to supplement the record because you could take notice of the upcoming findings of facts and conclusions of law in that case.
Take short time here on that. You better make a motion so the counsel can respond to it with regard to supplementing the record on that.
Well, yes, I would like to supplement so that the court may take note.
I'd like you to if there are further facts with regard to the remedy aspect of this, in other words, the harm issue.
Well, and it goes to the legal aspect, too, because in both...
Why you should ask that? Because I want you to succinctly tell me what you think the test is.
For?
In order to pierce the corporate veil.
Well, there's two elements that the case law says. I'll try to get them right here. The first point is, I think it's the abuse of the corporate veil, which we don't have in this case because they didn't rely on it in any way, shape, or form. They never looked at any of the records. They didn't even know that these properties existed at the time of contracting. What these properties provided was a fortuitous source of recovery.
What do you mean by abuse? Intentional disregard to the prejudice of creditors in general, to the prejudice of this creditor on this contract? That seems to me to be where this all got a little confused from the way I see it.
But the courts have looked at it in two different ways. They've looked at what is the pre-breach contact or conduct and what's the post-breach conduct. And the pre-breach conduct, the trial court clearly found was not part of did not warrant piercing. It was a 20-year-old process where he would put different projects in different boxes, and it wasn't to evade creditors. It's just his misunderstanding of how he should keep his taxes. On the post-tort activity, then the court looks at what happened, and is there a remedy? And the remedy is appropriate here, which was appropriate, was the fraudulent transfer avoidance, which the court did, giving the property back. If you were to pierce the corporate veil, you would reach through the corporation to the raise to get at assets that were never in the corporation in the first place. This was a hunt for some large stock accounts that they were trying to get at. And there's several cases that say, look, you take your defendants as you find them. You are not entitled to a solvent defendant, and it is impermissible for the court to use the notion of piercing corporate veil to create a fund to pay a judgment. And that's what they would do. They would reach through and take money that was never, ever in Unique Construction and then use that to apply it against the fees. There are a couple things, or against the judgment, there are a couple things that counsel said that I think I should point out I don't think is correct. The notion that somehow this 38th Street property was hidden, this is a recorded deed at the Pierce County Auditor's Office. Anyone can go online, type in unique construction, and in seconds have a complete list of all the deeds from unique construction. This was not a hidden thing. This is a problem they created so they could come into court and say, oh, well, if we don't have piercing, we're not going to have complete relief, because they didn't plead the case. The other thing that they brought up, you know, with regards to, my notes aren't as clear as I'd like them to
be. Was it tried by implication, though, during the trial?
What tried by implication?
The 38th Street property. Oh, you said it wasn't pled.
It wasn't.
Was it tried by implication?
No, I don't think Mr. Murphy and Northwest Cascade was putting on a case in that setting for piercing the court, or for setting aside that transaction. It was quite explicit they weren't. But they certainly were putting it on as evidence, both in the Fraudulent Transfer Act case as well as the piercing case, as evidence of common scheme, course of conduct, of badges of fraud and that. And there is extensive testimony as to the 38th Street property. And, in fact, I objected at one point. I said, this is not pled. This is not put forth to the jury. And in the March 14, 2012 transcript at 138, it starts, and the court says, well, no, we're going to let this in. And the court allowed it in. I made my objection that this shouldn't be in there, and the court said, I'm okay with it. All right, got anything else? Are we ready to bring the jury in? Let's go. And in the prior thing that I think you do have to see, when I originally objected in April of 2007 to any of this language in there, the court said, I'm not including the last sentence of the plaintiff's proposed finding 22. That's the portion that said it's a fraudulent transfer. This is the first time around.
Mm-hmm.
The court said, I will include the last sentence that says there was no consideration for any of the transfers of the 38th Street property because he, Mr. Murphy, argued it as being relevant to the issue of corporate disregard, which is the only issue these findings and conclusions should go towards. So the court was very much aware that it was being argued as evidence to the corporate disregard, and she's the one who weighed the evidence. That court is the one that's in the most appropriate position to do so. I'm not going to get to discuss the attorney's fees. I would just point out that they asked for 340% more than I asked for. They billed more in about the same in 2 months, October and March, that I billed in the entire case, and somehow my fees are unreasonable. I would say that I did segregate my fees. If you look through it, he may not like the way I segregated, but it's color-coded. Yellow for ones we won, green for ones we lost, and the other ones for ones that were substantially intertwined. The court also said it was substantially intertwined at multiple places. So I'd ask that you affirm that. I can't get to his fees today. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to come back to Judge Applewick's question about finding fact 22. I did look at that. I would submit that the strikeout of that is actually an error, in the sense that it was not supported by substantial evidence.
Well,
but I don't think it undermines what the argument is.
He makes the point, the court takes out the finding that it was fraudulent. The court says it's going to leave in the compensation. Then ultimately the court takes out that there was no compensation, suggesting there's no evidence, but at least evidencing that the court had the evidence in mind.
It may indicate the court had the evidence in mind, but it didn't properly consider the evidence under the legal standard under Morgan.
But aren't we at substantial evidence at that point?
No, that's not substantial evidence. The court's erroneous conclusion about what the evidence shows, when the evidence was virtually uncontroverted, I don't even think Mr. Burns would get up and say there was consideration for the transfer. There was not. The record is very clear in that.
No, regard. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, looking at the findings of fact as a whole, if it's clear she considered the 38th Street property and the 89th Street property and simply didn't agree with what you advocated, don't these findings support provide substantial evidence for her conclusion.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor, because if you look at her express statements on the record, she says in multiple times that she is not going to consider that as part of veil piercing. I think you have to read the record as a whole. I want to touch on a couple of other things that Mr. Burns said. He talks about this notion of money that was never in the corporation in the first place. Obviously, the 38th Avenue property was in the corporation, as was the $177,000 in cash that was diverted, saved the Rays from dipping into their trust account that had in excess of $600,000 in it. So these are assets that were corporate assets that were diverted. Your Honor had a question about tribe by implication. I don't think it was. I think it goes really to the question of what the evidence showed, and I think you have to look at the substantial evidence, not some random strikeout as suggesting more than what the judge actually said. I want to talk about the intent issue for just a minute as well. I'm going to jump over that and talk about the attorney's fees. If you get past the veil piercing, you have to address the fees awarded to the Rays on veil piercing. Counsel did not segregate the fees. He's simply wrong on that. And the trial court didn't rely on that. The trial court used a method that said, well, what would have happened if he had had his own lawyer and he went to every proceeding and participated in the case, including the 16 months the Rays were not parties? There's no basis in Washington law for that. You have to segregate. You have to rule out fees spent on matters that were not did not win on. They won on one issue that occupied 11% of the trial time in this case. And it just makes absolutely no sense to reward them for losing matters. It subverts the attorney's fees clause in the contract.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.